Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the men whose intelligence I admire most is our first guest. He is my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, a former senior advisor to then Vice President Richard Cheney, Dick Cheney. He has been in government in a number of capacities at the State Department, at the National Security Council, and of course in the Vice President's office. These days, he is riding herd on our efforts at the Center for Security Policy to attend to developments, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa. His name is Dr. David Wormser, a great ally, colleague, and friend. We're always delighted to have him with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back, David. Good to have you, sir.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for having me on. It's an honor. Always.
A pleasure. Listen, there's something going on that I think needs your gimlet eye to explain to the rest of us. We're focusing a lot of attention. Certainly, the Biden administration wants us to focus a lot of attention on Ukraine and what is happening there. It seems as though things could get very seriously out of hand as tensions build, as deployments are augmented by the Russians, and now the United States is talking about sending 8,500 troops to Eastern Europe. The NATO allies and the United States government are talking up the need to punish Russia very dramatically if it now not only invades Ukraine, but actually engages in even a minor incursion there. The question is this more theater than reality, as far as the United States is concerned, at least, because of something that's going on in a totally different part of the world, very much in your portfolio, namely the unbelievably fixated pursuit by the same people who brought us basically the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran 5 or 6 years ago, longer than that, I guess now, are at it again with Iran. So, David, essentially I'm asking you about two questions. One is, what's going on, as best you can tell, with respect to Ukraine and Russia on the one hand, and what's going on with respect to Russia and Iran?
Well, starting with Russia and Ukraine direct, I think what you're seeing is that Putin, he's probing whether he'll invade and whether he'll invade just the southern part or the whole country. These are difficult questions to answer, but one thing is clear, that he is succeeding a lot even without invading at this point. He's divided the Western alliance. We're at each other's throat. He's suddenly enjoyed seeing a huge anti-war movement emerge in the United States that, while it has merits, it at the same time, it confirms what Russia believes it sees and what many of us fear, which is the idea that America doesn't really have the willpower right now to be a superpower. So on one side, we see success for Russia even without a war, but then that leads to the very strong possibility that there will be some sort of Russian invasion, whether it's limited to the south, to the Donbas region, to Crimea, or whether it's the entire country, remains to be seen. So, in other words, he may not have thought he would do this last September, but the weakness shown has opened that door. The second thing related to Iran, it is very clear that, A, the United States is rattling its saber by some of these deployments and so forth to show strength, because the administration is facing political blowback here for the weakness it's shown. But I don't think that's real. These aren't the sort of moves that are genuinely geared toward deterring the Russians from invading. So I think this is more show, and the Russians know it. The real issue then becomes what can be traded off for what. This is the way I think the administration is looking at it. And right now, Frank, I think you fingered it perfectly. The administration is very obsessively focused on this Iran issue, because they know that we're reaching a critical point, a watershed moment where the Israelis cannot wait anymore, where others in the region cannot wait anymore, and that the Iranians are acting in an unbelievably unrestrained way right now. So for the administration, I think they may barter, they may enter a grand bargain with the Russians, where there's a level of acquiescence. There will be show resistance, but there's a level of acquiescence in what Russia may do geostrategically in an area that I am sure inside the administration, there's already a white flag of surrender in Eastern Europe, and that we give in to the Russians on that if the Russians will work with us on the Iran issue, and we see evidence of that already happening.
So let's talk a little bit about that evidence, David. First of all, I guess the question is, what help do you think the administration is soliciting from the Russians, or perhaps is currently receiving from them, for that matter? There's talk about some sort of secret agreement. Congress has not been read in on it to this point. I'm not sure that anybody else has seen it, perhaps not even our allies in these talks. But evidently, the Russians have been participating in its formulation and the midwifing it with the Iranians. So what do we know about what's going on and the contents of the agreement that might emerge from it?
Well, what we do know is going on, because we have numerous Western diplomats leaking this, is that we've turned to the Russians as the broker between us and the Iranians, which of course is very problematic. The Russians are an ally of Iran. So we've turned to Iran's ally to honestly broker a deal with Iran. And it looks as if there's a deal underway, because you've suddenly seen sanctions lifted, or let's put it more in terms of monetary. We've seen some frozen assets released by our allies over the last week, specifically South Korea. This does not happen without a green light from Washington. So we're beginning to signal to the Iranians via the Russians and via our allies that we're giving in on this issue. And then there's an admission by these diplomats that we're negotiating with Iran through Russia. Apparently Iran has at this point still turned down the deal, but it's clear there is a deal afoot. And the deal afoot seems to be lifting sanctions in return for some limited deal with the Iranians. In other words, we're not even going to get anything near where we were with the original very flawed joint, the JCPOA, or the Iran deal that we had 6 years ago. So it's a meltdown. By the way, the latest is that the Chinese have been invited also to help broker this. So we have a Russian-Chinese brokering of a deal with Iran. Both Russia and China are very closely aligned with Iran. And China has already said its aim is to use this to create a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Namely, their real target is Israel's nuclear program, not Iran's.
Well, at the very least, it serves as a pretext for allowing the Iranians to continue to have nuclear weapons, or, you know, assuming they acquire them, if they haven't already, to preserve that option. So, David, you're telling us that the Russians and now the Chinese are being importuned by the Biden administration to help them get some kind of agreement that in the end we will pay highly for, namely in terms of sanctions relief, as well as these other financial lubricants, including, last I heard, some $7 billion that the South Koreans had been holding. That's a lot of money for the, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, for example, and the kinds of things that it's engaged in the past would presumably be only ramped up. But worse yet, it will do nothing to actually alter the trajectory that the Iranians are on to fulfill their nuclear weapons ambitions. So I got that about right?
Yeah, no, you got it perfectly right. When Biden administration took office, Iran was down to almost nothing in terms of any assets. It was literally going bankrupt. And its activity suggested that. What little activity they could really focus on internationally was met with a fairly forceful response by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, certainly by Israel, and then even to some extent by Egypt in certain places. So the Iranians really were at a dead end a year ago. If you look at their foreign reserve holdings right now, they're very high. They're multiples higher. I thought somewhere in the vicinity of 10 times at least as high as they were only 12 months ago. Certainly it's more than that. I just can't remember the number. But at any rate, they're now they have money to spend, and we see where they're spending it. They're spending it in radically expanding their nuclear program and galloping now, if not outright sprinting toward a bomb. Number one. Number two, they've launched a new war from Yemen onto the UAE, where now we're treated every day or two to a missile attack onto this critical ally of the United States and financial center. So what we have now is an Iranian war launched via Yemen, via the Houthis in Yemen on the UAE, which treats us literally now every other night to another missile attack on Abu Dhabi, God forbid on Dubai with its very large and tall buildings and so forth. So we have this escalation of Iranian activity that is funded by the monies that we are releasing. This is not the first, by the way, goodwill gesture that we've sent the Iranians. A year ago, we allowed the South Koreans and some other allies to release some of the funds as well. I believe it was around $12 billion back then. This money is being spent to prosecute wars against our allies. The big one, of course, that's expensive for Iran is the one against Israel. And we're seeing an escalation of that. And I would not be surprised if by the end of the week we don't see an attack from Yemen, from the Houthis, on Israel itself.
Wow.
So
you think they've got that capability?
I do believe they have that capability. The amount of drone and missile escalation, or not escalation, but expansion of Iranian power in the last year, using, you know, gratitude of the in gratitude for all the monies that we've released to them, they've developed this aggressive missile and drone force over the last year that deeply threatens countries as far away as 1,000 and a half miles, and it's very dangerous, very, very dangerous.
And in the instance that you're talking about, say a drone strike, do you think Israel would be able to discern from whence it came?
Yes, they will clearly know where it came from. And fortunately, I think the Israelis will largely have the ability to stop it before it does any real damage. But it opens up a new front, and the Israelis now are encircled. They have the Hezbollah from the north. But more than this, it's the image in the region that is emerging that the United States has yielded to the Iranians as a superpower, and that the Iranians now have a free path to aggression.
And not only that, David, but just to tie this back to what we were talking about a moment ago, they are not only the regional hegemon in the making, aside from, you know, the capabilities of Israel, of course, but they are also backed to the hilt by the Chinese and the Russians. And the folks who had bet on the United States in the past, notably Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, varying degrees others in the Gulf, Kuwait most notably, and of course Israel, have seemingly backed the weak horse, as Osama bin Laden used to say. And all of this, it comes on top of the other things that we just were talking about, and the big drama from last year, the abandonment of our allies in Afghanistan. It's hard to imagine a more fraught strategic environment for the free world, or people who at least want to be aligned with it. And I guess, David, you know, your decades of experience in national security policymaking, your experience as a naval intelligence officer before all of that, your time in the private sector analyzing these policies, have you seen in your professional life a more dangerous moment?
Not in my lifetime, no. By the way, I'd add in there Latin America, that the complete collapse of our position and support for allies like Colombia and Latin America is also a similar circumstance now. No, I have not. I have not seen a situation where our allies are running for cover to the level that they are. Our enemies are encouraged and beginning to push doors, see how open they are, to find that they are more open than even they had imagined. And the delusional quality in Washington that seeks to engage in a diplomacy that has no foundations. One of the things I read yesterday was that we were thinking of offering the Russians perhaps something on Iran, something that we, for the sake of conceding on the issue of NATO in Eastern Europe, because, quote, any rate, it is a meaningless, it's a meaningless position that we have. In other words, we're conceding something that we anyway have no intention of executing. Well, this is horrifying. We're admitting in our diplomacy that we essentially have nothing even that we want to offer the Russians because we've already conceded it. Putin is no fool. He knows this. He's not going to be snookered to take a concession that's meaningless from us.
Well, I think what you're saying, if I understand it correctly, is not so much that we have nothing to offer him, but that the ultimate concession is we don't believe in standing with our allies. We're not prepared to do it. There's nothing there in terms of our putative position of robustly defending NATO or a NATO wannabe nation like Ukraine. And again, David, it just seems to me when you rack and stack all of this, what you've got is an environment in which we could well find ourselves, perhaps by inadvertence or miscalculation, but certainly as a cumulative effect, the result of all of these missteps, incompetent actions, malfeasance, complicity with our enemies at the cusp of a global war. And as you say, it could extend very well into our own hemisphere. It's not just someplace else far away. So all I can say is God help us. David, thank you for the help that you're providing in clarifying all these issues and what's at stake and the importance of taking, to the best of our ability, steps to enhance our deterrence of these kinds of actions. And we'll be rolling out more of that in the near future with your good help. Thank you so much, David Wormser, for all you do these days at the Center for Security Policy. We appreciate you tremendously, and your visits with us can't come often enough. So we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Lawrence Sellin. We'll drill down a bit more on the threats from the Chinese Communist Party, particularly in the biological warfare space, and what we are doing to enable them. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, retired after 29 years or so of distinguished service in uniform. He's gone on to work in the business sector and the research community, and now is a very important contributor to our understanding of the COVID-19 virus, the extent to which it is a product of a biological warfare program that the Chinese Communist Party is not allowed to have, but does, and to which we have provided, as Lawrence Sellin has documented, among other places, in a series of extraordinarily important articles at the Gateway Pundit, we have continuing taxpayer underwritten support going to agents of and even facilities associated with this biological capability that is designed to destroy our country. It's just an unbelievable story, and we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with Lawrence and get the latest from him on his research in this space. Thank you so much for joining us, Colonel Doctor. It's good to have you with us as always.
Thank you, Frank.
Just again, to level set a little bit, Lawrence, I think our audience is pretty familiar both with you and with your work, but am I overstating it to say that we now know the Chinese Communist Party has an extensive infrastructure across China, both dedicated and supporting, enabling the pursuit of biological weapons capabilities designed to assist China in its effort to dominate the world, among other things, by destroying our own country?
That's exactly right, Frank. In 2016, the Chinese Communist Party mandated the fusion of civilian military research, in particular in the area of biowarfare, and the the structure of China's biowarfare program is at three levels. First, the first core secret military level involves military research centers and military hospitals, but layered on top of that and fused to that first layer are all Chinese universities and all, quote, civilian research centers like the Wuhan Institute of Virology and some of China's biotech companies. Now, it is that second level that gives access to the People's Liberation Army to expertise outside of China, in particular universities in the United States, which are ostensibly contributing to China's biowarfare program through the what I call scientific chain migration of Chinese scientists to the United States. So it is that fused...
It's a great term for describing what's going on here.
Yes, indeed. And it is that fused civilian military research program in China, which has developed agents like COVID-19 to be used against adversaries, in particular the United States, to essentially subjugate us.
Yeah. Well, as I understand it, they even said to depopulate our country so it can be colonized by the Chinese, to put a fine point on it. And Lawrence, again, at the risk of belaboring this, the thing that I find stunning is that the more we've learned about this Chinese biological weapons capability, the less I've heard about the fact that this is a direct and material violation of a treaty obligation that the Chinese freely assumed not to have a biological warfare offensive capability. Defenses are a different story, but this is clearly of an offensive character. Are you struck by the seeming indifference to the fact that this is such a violation of a treaty obligation?
Yeah, I'm astounded that there's been relatively no reaction from the U.S. government to COVID-19, which is clearly a bioweapon that was developed specifically to essentially decrease the U.S. capability, both militarily and economically.
Let me just turn then to one of the things that we've learned about this biological warfare capability and its tie to the COVID-19 virus is that members of the United States government, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, actually were privy to information about that reality. And in fact, the support for such a capability that the United States government had given through agencies like his to enable this biological warfare capability to become more proficient. Tell us a little bit about what we've learned in that regard, Lawrence.
Well, we've learned recently, Frank, through the House Republicans who released emails from Dr. Anthony Fauci and National Institutes of Health Director Francis Collins. Now, according to these emails that were released by January 27, 2020, which is very early in the pandemic, Fauci knew that he had funded the EcoHealth Alliance, which had funneled money to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and Fauci knew he had funded dangerous gain-of-function research with the potential for bioweapon development. Now, on February 1, 2020, again, very early in the pandemic, Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins, and at least 11 other scientists convened a conference call to discuss COVID-19. And it was at that conference call that Fauci and Collins were first warned that COVID-19 may have leaked from a Chinese laboratory and may have been genetically manipulated. Now, during the next 3 days, it was decided by Fauci, Collins, and those scientists who participated in the discussions, many of whom could be considered complicit in the creation of COVID-19, that they would intentionally suppress any public discussion that COVID-19 had originated in a Chinese laboratory.
In other words, we now know that not only were key members of the United States government who've become household names in the course of this pandemic bore direct responsibility for the pandemic, or at least for the creation of the virus that was the impetus behind it, and knew that they had that culpability early on and concealed that information, indeed lied about both the nature of the virus and their involvement with it. This is a stunning set of facts, Lawrence. Have I gotten any of them wrong?
No, you haven't gotten it wrong. And it's not just those initial days of the pandemic where they decided, you know, to suppress any discussion about the laboratory origin of COVID-19. They went on to essentially execute a propaganda campaign together with the Chinese Communist Party by publishing articles within scientific journals and working with big tech to suppress any discussion whatsoever that COVID-19 could have possibly come from a Chinese laboratory. So this was not just an initial reaction. It was a long-term campaign by members of the U.S. government like Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins and the scientists who could be considered complicit in helping China create COVID-19.
Lawrence, as I say, I find this staggeringly alarming. And again, some of it has been sort of trickling out. You've been writing about it. Others have more recently. And yet, you know, I'm reminded of the famous line, where's the outrage? Where is the holding accountable people for, again, gross malfeasance is, I think, the most charitable way you can describe this. It's treason when you think about it in terms of actual enhancement of the capabilities of our most dangerous enemy to destroy this country. And there seems to be, with, I think it's fair to say, the notable exception of a couple of United States senators and a couple of congressmen, I guess, Ron Johnson, notably, Rand Paul, among them. But Lawrence, you're repeatedly laying out the facts at Gateway Pundit, most especially, along these lines and others. And I want to come to some more that are even more outrageous in a way, knowing what we now know. But it must be just infuriating to you as a national security professional of great distinction in a variety of capacities, including with a specialty in virology, for heaven's sakes. Clinical, you know, experience in this space at Fort Detrick, no less, that this has been done by other elements of the United States government. And worse, to turn to that other point, it's still going on. We're still supporting the Chinese biological warfare program. Tell us about that and how and where that's happening.
Well, as I said earlier, Frank, over the last 30 years, there has been a scientific chain migration of scientists trained in the People's Republic of China who have established themselves in laboratories in the United States, some becoming U.S. citizens, but maintaining an allegiance to China. Now, one could call these scientific double agents. They use U.S. taxpayer funding to conduct collaborative research with scientists in China, some of which are from the People's Liberation Army. Now we have direct evidence that over these last 30 years, these Chinese scientists, many of who have come to the United States, have been part of an organized espionage program run by China's state security apparatus. Now, one of the most prominent of those is Shibu Zhang, a People's Liberation Army scientist who had a key position as a link between China's biowarfare program and a network of Chinese scientists operating in the U.S. on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party. And this has been well documented this in the Gateway Pundit. Now, briefly, this Shibu Zhang obtained his MS and medical degree from the People's Liberation Army First Military Medical University and the Fourth Military Medical University, respectively. Over the last 20 of the over 20 years working in the United States, Shibu Zhang developed an extensive network of collaborative research with other U.S. virus research laboratories and received more than $17 million in research grants coming from Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Now, during this entire period, Shibu Zhang actively collaborated with People's Liberation Army laboratories and simultaneously inviting into his U.S. laboratory and training scientists linked to the Chinese military. Now, according to the sources from inside China, we've established that Shibu Zhang has been identified as an agent of China's state security apparatus. In fact, he has a code name, which is called, he's called Pu Yu, which is fine jade in Chinese. Now, it appears that all the code names of Chinese scientists overseas who are working for the Chinese intelligence have these gemstone names. Another one is Yang Yi Wang, who's actually head of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Now, go ahead, Frank. Sorry.
No. I'm just remarking on the evidence that you're laying out that continues to build of both the extent of this biological warfare program and its assets, and the fact that we're learning more and more about who are the principals in it and how many of them have ties here in the United States. And Lawrence, I just have to ask you, again, as a national security professional, as a man with great competency in this particular national security battle space, for want of a better term, what is the cumulative effect on our national security of having agents of the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese Communist Party continuing to hoover up our research, our technologies, our techniques that can be directly applicable, not that we're using them for this purpose, but that can be directly applicable to their illegal biological warfare agenda?
Well, essentially, Frank, U.S. Government officials are using U.S. taxpayer dollars essentially to subsidize China's biowarfare program, because all of what I've told you is still going on. We're still accepting these Chinese scientists in the United States at universities who have associations with the U.S. Defense Department, for example. And we're doing nothing to stop that. And the gain of function experiments are still going on and still being funded by the National Institutes of Health.
I get that. What I'm asking is basically your assessment of what are the consequences. What is the likely benefit to the Chinese of all of what you've just laid out?
Well, what the Chinese have done is colonize our research programs in the United States and are essentially using our knowledge, skills, and technologies to feed into their biowarfare program. I think that's
okay. If all of that is true, I guess I'm just asking for a bottom line. Would that likely be making, in your professional judgment, Lawrence Sellin, a material contribution to the threat that we're facing here in the United States? That, I mean, is this something that is just, you know, additional knowledge, or is it enhanced peril for the American people that is a direct result of what our tax dollars are being utilized to obtain?
Well, we're contributing to our own demise, because the Chinese are using our knowledge, skills, and technologies, and even our funding to feed into their biowarfare program to create bioweapons that can be used against the United States. It's that simple.
It's that simple, and it's that terrifying. Lawrence Sellin, as always, thank you for an extraordinarily important wake-up call. I hope that we can continue to collaborate with you and try to make sure that it is not only heard, but acted upon by our government before, God forbid, these weapons enabled by us are used against us to an even greater extent than COVID-19. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Ross Kennedy about food security and what the Chinese are doing to threaten ours in that regard as well. Straight ahead.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. According to legend, a single courageous Roman warrior named Horatius successfully defended a bridge against an invading army, sparing his city from certain destruction. It turns out that we have a Horatius in the U.S. Senate, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Yesterday, Senator Johnson convened an informal hearing about the COVID-19 virus and the toll it has needlessly taken on our countrymen and women due to governmental and media ineptitude and malfeasance. He took 5 hours of testimony from leading medical practitioners, vaccine victims, and other experts who participated in an extraordinary Defeat the Mandates march in Washington the day before. On this issue, and the big lie about January 6th being an insurrection, Senator Johnson is single-handedly showing his Republican colleagues what they can and must do this year, even in the minority, namely expose the truth. Godspeed, Horatius Johnson. This is Frank Affney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
After commanding in World War I, he became superintendent of West Point. and at the age of 30, became the youngest chief of staff of the U.S. Army. During World War II, he became Allied Supreme Commander in the Southwest Pacific and received the surrender of the Japanese. He served as commander of the UN forces during the Korean War. His name was Douglas MacArthur, and he was born this day, January 26, 1880. To the cadets at West Point, Douglas MacArthur stated, "The soldier, above all other men, is required to practice the greatest act of religious training, sacrifice."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time by an individual I've just come across by the name of Ross Kennedy. He is the founder of Fortis Analysis and a specialist in a particular line of logistics that is of surpassing importance and fear is getting altogether too little attention at a moment when we are addressing, as we do every day on this program, the growing threats to our country, particularly emanating from the Chinese Communist Party. As part of its unrestricted warfare portfolio, the Chinese have worked assiduously to develop means of undermining us, attacking us, subverting us, and otherwise defeating us. We talked a moment ago with Lawrence Sellin about biological weapons and the role that they could play in those objectives. Ross Kennedy is going to talk with us about another line of attack, potentially. It's how the Chinese have worked to position themselves to exploit it, perhaps devastatingly. Ross, it's good to have you. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. So glad to have a chance to finally catch up with you and learn about some of your analysis and the research behind it.
Well, the honor is mine, Mr. Gaffney. Thank you for the time. And I certainly concur with you that this is a little known but extremely important strategic issue for the United States.
I want to hear more about it. So let's talk about food insecurity and the extent to which some of the things that the Chinese have been doing well, in a variety of ways, are likely to compromise ours.
It's a very interesting dynamic here that the U.S., which is really on a per-acre basis still far and away the most productive country in the world in terms of creating calories for human consumption. We have unbelievably fertile soil. We have really fantastic weather. So when we take a look at agricultural productivity on a per acre basis, the U.S. for a long, long time has been the global leader in output. And China, you know, by comparison, has routinely struggled with it. Only about 8%, as big as China is, you know, geographically very very similar size to the United States, it is not nearly as rich in biodiversity, particularly of the kind of soil and weather patterns that are conducive to, extraordinary bounty of crop production. Only about 8% of the land in China is arable. The number is much higher in the United States. And we just have a number of significant advantages that really make us a desirable partner on the food and feed side.
A desirable partner, to be sure. And this has been, of course, the theory that we've operated under for many years in terms of engaging with China, that we can partner to our mutual benefit, we can collaborate, we can share with them technology and even industrial capabilities, and that will redound not simply to the betterment of the condition of the people of China, but also ours and for that matter, the world. What you've described, though, understood as a dual-use capability for China, makes that partnering line a little bit less compelling. Walk us through particularly this idea of the feeds for agricultural purposes, the amino acids and so on, and what the Chinese have done that make them not so much perhaps a partner, but a threat.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The animal feed in the United States.
And let me just say, I should have mentioned this before. Much of this is laid out, important piece that you wrote at Human Terrain earlier this month, entitled Belt and Road Comes to the Heartland. And you might tell us just a little bit what that's a reference to, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So since 2013, China has been engaged in a what was initially presented as infrastructure partnerships in various strategic countries around the world. And I say strategic in terms of a combination of geography and critical mineral or agricultural resources, in addition to, in some cases like Djibouti, for example, where very few mineral resources to be found, but sits at a critical maritime choke point, opposite Yemen, at the south of the Red Sea. So when we look at these projects, China is positioned through a combination of infrastructure and investments and essentially co-opting these countries through debt diplomacy, promises of hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in investment into these countries to build out infrastructure. But if the country cannot make good on its debts, then those infrastructure partnerships become essentially a form of loan sharking, where China will take possession of the asset. It has happened a couple of times, but they exert leverage in other ways. You know, we'll forgive the debt or we'll extend the repayment terms if you do X, Y, or Z for us. And the reason I titled this that is that the mentality of Belt and Road is predatory. Essentially, it's strategic and it's predatory. However it's presented in the media and however much apologetics is engaged in for it, both in the West and elsewhere. And in this
I call it sort of payday loans arrangements, not just debt trap. It's really, as you say, predatory. And what we've been witnessing, of course, is in a lot of places where it's been applied, the Chinese have seized the assets that they have built on those defaulted loans. And it's a staggeringly efficient way, it seems, of building out a colonial global infrastructure. Not just for dominating food production or mineral recovery or commerce in various places across the globe, but power projection as well. Am I right?
It absolutely is. One of the things I often talk about, because so much of my background is within agriculture, specifically agricultural supply chain on a global basis, much of which has been tied to China throughout my career. There's really three, what I call last dollar or final dollar commodities. And that is, what are the three things that a country will spend its last dollar on to secure stability if it had to? And the answer is food, water, and energy. One of those three things is when push comes to shove, that is the three things that a country, a government will emphasize above all others in order to maintain power or maintain stability of the population. You know, usually two factors that go hand in hand.
You know, it's interesting, Ross, I believe it was Gordon Chang who introduced me to this point, that there is an expression that is commonly used in China when greeting somebody on the street, for example, and that is, have you eaten lately? Which bespeaks a lot of very bad history in China, as you know, with food scarcity or outright mass starvation. And so it brings me to the present moment where China is simultaneously confronting, as you know, food scarcity at this very instant, and is beavering away at hoarding food, hoarding grains, hoarding corn. To your point about the Belt and Road coming to the heartland, putting itself in a position to dominate others' production of food, including ours. And that's not just with respect to these amino acids and the fertilizers and so on. It's also with respect, as I understand it, to simply buying up large tranches of our agricultural productive land. Talk about that, if you would, as well.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about the Belt and Road comes to the heartland, the company in question, Fufeng Group, is how it is really in so many ways a perfect synthesis of all of these issues. Particularly at the strategic competition level for calories and for protein between China and the U.S. And it does involve the purchase of a significant quantity of farm ground and industrial space, about 370 acres. They're positioning it Grand Forks, and I'm not disparaging the good people or the good state of North Dakota, but Grand Forks is not really a place, if my pure intention is to build out a $300 or $400 or $500 million wet corn mill and amino acid manufacturing plant, it doesn't make a lot of sense to put it in Grand Forks, North Dakota, given the preponderance of many other better locations for numerous reasons. But it does have the advantage of sitting 13 miles away, direct line of sight to Grand Forks Air Force Base. And so you're talking about a confluence of, it's a play to take American energy, American labor, American technical know-how, and American grain production and turn it into a product that is easily exportable, that is not sanctioned, that can be exported to countries that are friendlier to China. From a finished meat sales standpoint, could be Canada, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, or any number of other places, and convert that into a strategic tool to satisfy their food demand while also robbing the United States of amino acids that we require as well for animal protein production, while also being able to potentially engage in other forms of espionage or nefarious activities, being so close to a major military installation.
Yeah, sabotage. Look, let's give the devil their due. The Chinese Communist Party is astute, is determined, is patient, and is absolutely committed to our destruction. And you document in this piece the lengths to which the good people, as you say, of North Dakota, their governor, Doug Burgum, and state legislature, and so on, are rolling out the red carpet for this Chinese facility, subsidies and other inducements to come to North Dakota. But again, as was true of a wind farm that was to be built on a huge stretch, I think 200 square miles or so of Texas land, not too far from a major American Air Force base. This is not an accident, comrade, as the Soviets like to say. And so just to wrap this up, you've got a facility that has truly strategic implications in terms of this food security business. You have Americans unwittingly enabling it to be built in our country, potentially to our detriment, net-net. And on top of it, there may well be further benefits to the Chinese of having such a presence in a strategically located place. What could possibly go wrong, I guess, is the question that must be asked.
Yeah, it's a great number of things. The United States, as we know, has done very, very little to secure our own manufacturing sovereignty. Even on the food side, even something that's such a historical strength for us, which is agricultural and biotechnology output. And this is another example of how, as one falls, another rises. It is a zero-sum game. A bushel of corn can only be turned into so many things. And if a manufacturing facility is being built that's going to consume X number of, in this case, about 25 million bushels of corn per year, that's 25 million bushels of corn that is not being exported to a friendlier U.S. ally, or not being processed at an American-owned wet corn mill or a production, amino acid production facility. It is zero sum when you're talking about a physical thing that can only be grown and consumed once and cannot be grown and consumed again for another year. And China understands this very well.
So just to wrap this up for today, and I want to come back to you for a longer conversation soon, if I can, Ross Kennedy, about other aspects of food insecurity, one of which actually is part of the conversation that I had with Lawrence Sellin immediately before this one, and that is the potential use of biological
agents to attack the agricultural, you know, productivity of a country, with, again, potentially devastating effect on its food supply. And whether
it's a serious fear.
The Chinese are capable of doing such a thing, especially having hoarded food as part of their perhaps run-up to military operations against Taiwan and maybe against us that that might involve any number of these sorts of unrestricted warfare techniques of the non-kinetic kind, but perhaps also of the kinetic kind. But all of that's for another day. I just wanted to say thank you for your time on this occasion and for shedding light on what's going on in North Dakota. I hope that as a result of your work, there will be a fresh look taken at what the Chinese are up to here and whether we should be enabling it, let alone putting it in such a very, very problematic location. Thank you, Ross Kennedy. Keep up the good work and do come back to us very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. According to legend, a single courageous Roman warrior named Horatius successfully defended a bridge against an invading army, sparing his city from certain destruction. It turns out that we have a Horatius in the U.S. Senate, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Yesterday, Senator Johnson convened an informal hearing about the COVID-19 virus and the toll it has needlessly taken on our countrymen and women due to governmental and media ineptitude and malfeasance. He took 5 hours of testimony from leading medical practitioners, vaccine victims, and other experts who participated in an extraordinary Defeat the Mandates march in Washington the day before. On this issue and the big lie about January 6th being an insurrection, Senator Johnson is single-handedly showing his Republican colleagues what they can and must do this year, even in the minority, namely expose the truth. Godspeed, Horatius Johnson. This is Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.